Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayrick, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, we hate to sound like a broken record around here, but when it comes to financial markets, it's all about inflation again. Both the stock and bond markets got off to a roaring start to the year following a disastrous 2022, amid hopes that last year's surge in consumer prices had finally been tamed. But that strong start has mostly been reversed following some higher than expected inflation readings both in the US and Europe. So where do we stand now? Are these recent reports just potholes on the road to the normalization of inflation, or is something else going on? And what does it all mean for the path of interest rates? We'll get into it with a very influential economist who's best known for being vice chair of the Federal Reserve and a member of President Bill Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors in the 1990s. He's got a new book out, and it's all about the history of monetary and fiscal policy in the U.S. But first, Valdana, I have to say I'm excited about this guest for two reasons. One, I think he's the perfect guest to sort of talk about all the issues affecting markets these days. But also, do you remember how excited I got a few weeks ago? Unreasonably excited when I got to ride the dinky.
Yes, I remember.
You remember what the dinky is?
You were super happy. Is it a train or a bus?
It's a train. It's the shortest, I believe, and maybe our guest can correct me. It's the shortest train line, commuter train line in the U.S. It's like 2.5 miles. It goes from Princeton Junction to Princeton.
To Princeton University or Princeton Town, the town? Okay.
Well, yes, to both.
Yeah.
It lands right on campus. You were not as excited when I got to ride that as I was.
No, because how long of a ride is that? A minute?
I think it's like 5 minutes.
Okay, so you can't even sit down. You can't even have a snack.
Yeah, I can. You have to snack quickly. That's what makes it exciting is the superlative of the shortest ever train line.
I've never been on it. Maybe you and I can make a trip out there.
We should.
I think our guest has been on it.
Including our guest. I bet he's ridden it.
I have many times.
Okay, well, before you tell us more, it's the person speaking is Alan Blinder. He's a professor of economics at Princeton, and he's a former Fed vice chair. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, sure. You're welcome.
How has the dinky been riding it?
Well, I haven't ridden it lately. I mean, that's the way to get to New York. And I used to go to New York quite a lot. Two things happened. The obvious one is the pandemic, and I don't go there very much anymore. The non-obvious one is we had some grandchildren, little ones in Washington. So my wife and I now go south more often than we go north.
Oh, let's get into sort of the current state of the markets. And by the way, congratulations on your book. I'm about halfway through it. It's really fascinating. And I think just a really important read for anyone who wants to get an overview of sort of how we got where we are and sort of the dynamic between monetary and fiscal policy and sometimes frictions, I guess you could say. But I'm curious how you're thinking right now about inflation. You had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal earlier this year in which you were very optimistic that perhaps we'd seen the worst of inflation. You look at sort of the first half of the year, 2022 versus the second half. It was super hot, double-digit inflation in the first half. And then back closer to the Fed's target in the second half, you know, if you look at it, month over month on an annualized basis. I think it was 3 months annualized basis. Correct me if I'm wrong. But we have seen sort of renewed concern about inflation. The January numbers were a little hotter, both PCE and CPI. this week, the market's reacting pretty strongly to France, Spain, and Germany reporting hotter than expected inflation. How are you thinking about it now? Is there still reason to be optimistic that we're trending in the right direction? You know, is this just sort of a pothole on that road to normalization, or is there any reason to be more concerned?
I think it's more of a pothole with one big exception. And this is my beef with the Bureau of Labor Statistics that I usually love. It's one of the great statistical agencies in the world. But what they did after I wrote that Wall Street Journal piece that you correctly referred to, this is going to sound very wonkish, changed the seasonal adjustment factors. So it's no longer true if you look at the year. When I wrote that piece, it was true that, roughly speaking, inflation in 2022 was about 11% annual rate in the first half and about a 2% annual rate in the second half. Wow, that's quite a difference. It's nothing like that now because of changing the seasonals, which, you know, struck me as dirty pool for a prognosticator. I was looking at what turned out to be wrong data. That said, the qualitative story that of lower inflation in the second half than in the first half remains true. That did not disappear from the data. It's also mostly universal. I won't say every country, but it's certainly true in Europe and in most other countries. But in terms of magnitude, nothing like what it was before they changed the data. And that's the sense in which I view it as a kind of a pothole, but a pothole now on a road that's not as steeply declining as we used to think, but declining. That's important.
So can you tell us more about this? Because this piece, it did come out a couple of weeks ago before we got the minutes from the last Fed meeting. But you said the Fed now has a good chance at a soft economic landing.
Yeah, because of this data revision, I'm revising that. We all revise things when we get new data. I'm revising that to be a little less optimistic. I think they still have a chance, but it's a tougher chance than it was. You know, just to repeat, with the old data, by late in 2022, we were pretty close to the target where the Fed wanted to be. But with the new data, we're not quite as close. And among other things, that means the Fed is likely to raise interest rates more.
Okay, I have a bunch of follow-up questions about this because there's a bunch of debates going on, especially when I'm hearing people on Bloomberg TV or people I talk to on a daily basis. A lot of them are saying that a 6% Fed funds rate is a real possibility. To what extent you would agree with that?
No, I'd bet against that. It's not beyond the realm of the possible. You're reminding me a bit when I was on the Fed in ancient times in the 1990s. You're too young to remember this. When we were tightening in 94, 95, market sentiments at one point, not just for a day, but for a while, was that we were going to go up to 8% on the federal funds rate. I remember sitting there in my office in Washington saying, are those people crazy? We're not going to go anywhere near 8%. But in those days, you weren't allowed to say anything. Those are the days when the Fed was mum. And if the markets flew off in some wild direction, Alan Greenspan, who was the chairman, wouldn't do anything to bring them back. Eventually, events brought them back. And in fact, we topped out coincidentally at 6%, not 8%. So I'd be surprised if we get to 6.
I want to get into that idea of the Fed staying mum and sort of compare and contrast that with today. But first, before we do that, I think two things have shifted in the sort of the market's view of where the Fed's rate is going to go. One is exactly how high it's going to go. And we can debate 5.25, 5.5 or 6. But I think what's more alarming to investors these days is the notion that it's going to stay there for a while. You know, we came into this year, if you looked at the dot plot, which is the Fed's individual members' projections of where they see the Fed funds rate, or even market pricing in the SOFR or Fed funds futures markets, that, you know, it seemed to be a unanimous consensus almost that rate would peak maybe this spring, early summer, and then immediately come down that the Fed would pivot and start cutting rates. That seems to be, you know, the dot plot hasn't been updated yet, but I'm assuming what it is that pivot's no longer going to be there. And in the pricing of the, you know, SOFR and Fed funds futures market, it's no longer there either. Is that the correct interpretation and view of the rest of the year, do you think?
I think so. I think the markets were frankly a little bit wacky when they had this, as you correctly characterized, view that the Fed was going to go up to a peak and then right down. That's not what usually happens with monetary policy. The much more likely scenario always was it was going to go up to some peak, and one could debate, and people did debate, where that peak would be, and then hang around there for a while, see what happens. The same thing is true when the Fed is going down. It goes down for a while, it flattens out usually, to wait and watch. Wait and watch what? Among other things, the effects of the policy it's already promulgated, and then keep moving if necessary, or reverse if that seems appropriate. So I never thought that was a likely scenario, and I'm glad to see the markets don't believe it anymore.
And what about the debate that the Fed will have to rethink its 2% target? And we've had guests on this podcast as well arguing that maybe they should be rethinking that the 2% just isn't very realistic.
So let me assure you of one thing, and then I'll elaborate slightly. There is no debate inside the Fed. None. Zero. It is not going to happen. Bet your whole portfolio on it. All right? The Fed is not changing its target. Now, a broader question, which is interesting to economists and historians, we're talking about a book on economic history here, is whether it should have set a higher number when it did latch on to a target, not 2%. I think that's quite debatable, and I think I'd be on the side of, yes, it should have gone higher. So why do I say both? Because the reason is the same answer to the reason why is there no debate at the Fed? Because it would look like caving, giving in, surrendering. We can't do it, so we're going to make our target easier. And immediately people would start saying, oh, you went up to 3. How do I know you don't go up to 4? And those are the kinds of reasons why the Fed will never, ever, ever, well, ever is much too long. Let's say for the next 35 years, the Fed is not going to think about changing the target.
What would have been, in your view, a better target than 2%?
I thought 3 would be better than 2. And the main reason is what we were experiencing before the pandemic with zero, quote, zero interest rates, that if it was 3 rather than 2, the Fed would have had more room as the economy cratered to push the economy out of the crater with lower interest rates, as if it had started with interest rates 100 basis points higher than it did, it would have had 100 basis points more easing before it had to resort to these so-called unconventional policies.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Well, and I think maybe an important distinction to draw is the idea of, well, the Fed may not change that 2% target. I assume that doesn't necessarily mean that they won't pause or pivot before it gets to 2, right?
Absolutely. I think they'll pause, not pivot. That's what we were talking about before. They'll pause once inflation gets low enough and is falling, so that 2%, so to speak, is in sight. Then they'll pause to see, all right, is it going to 2? Is it not going to 2? How's the economy look? And so on.
What about other areas within the economy? You actually hear this question a lot, and I ask this question a lot when I'm talking to people. Like, where actually are we seeing any weakness? Or I'm thinking about the housing market. I get a ton of notes in my inbox on a daily basis that says the housing market now is also showing signs of perking up and of a turnaround, and the consumer remains strong, et cetera, et cetera. So where might you point to even show any weakness right now?
I point to the housing market, and I'm getting the same emails that you're getting, or some of them. And if you look at the graphs that accompany with them, it looks like it's gone down, down, down a huge way, and then a tiny little uptick. Let me see that uptick grow over months, and then I'll start getting worried. And the reason I say that is that classically, for decades, if you ask people on the Fed, away from microphones, so it's not being recorded by Bloomberg, where do you think you can do your damage or help, for that matter, if it's the other direction, on the economy, they'll say housing. Housing is by far the most sensitive to interest rates. And to me, despite these little blips of optimism very lately, housing is well down, and that's what you'd expect. The second place, by the way, is more puzzling, and I can't figure it out, which is automobile purchases. They generally respond to interest rates a lot. And the reason I can't figure it out, or the reason maybe there are people that are more expert in the auto market than I, is, as you remember, we had all these shortages. The manufacturers couldn't make enough cars because they couldn't get enough chips, and so on and so forth. And there have been some unusual fluctuations. So you wouldn't want to attribute those downdrafts to interest rates. And that sort of confused the whole picture. So I don't know what to make of automobiles. I just haven't studied it enough. Maybe if I had, I'd have a clearer pictures. But those are the two places. And the third, which is also down, is business investment. The worst of this past recession caused by the pandemic was in consumer services. Anybody who was expecting the Fed's tightening to affect spending on consumer services was not paying attention to history. It doesn't have any effect, zero. Now, that's a big hunk of the economy, but even in the good old days when nobody questioned whether the Fed could push the economy around, like the Volcker days or the Greenspan days, nobody on earth, nobody at the Fed, I don't want to speak about the whole earth, no, nobody at the Fed ever thought they were able to either push up or push down consumer spending on services.
You know, Professor, it's interesting how 100% of the discussion around fighting inflation these days relates to monetary policy and what the Fed can or can't do. A part of your book that I found really fascinating is you get into the 60s during the presidency of JFK and LBJ, and how the Keynesian economists had really come into power and, you know, and influence under both of those administrations. And, you know, the notion of, you know, using fiscal spending to boost demand, don't let worries about the deficit really handcuff you in that sense. And you talk about how Keynesians sort of got a bad rap back then because inflation accelerated pretty fast during the Vietnam War because of all the defense outlays. And Keynesians were actually advising on fiscal restraint to bring down inflation. And as you point out, I think, you know, and this to me is kind of relates to today's world too, with modern monetary theory, in that it's very easy for a politician to go out there and promise lower taxes, more spending, that sort of thing. It's pretty much political suicide to suggest some kind of fiscal constraint and higher taxes, less spending in order to help reduce inflation. Is it just a lost cause to ever think that fiscal policy could or will ever be used in the fight against inflation? Is it just too politically impossible to even consider anymore?
Yes, in a word. I wish it weren't true, but I think it is true. One of the things I discovered in researching and writing this book is, and this is to your point, The last time fiscal policy was used deliberately by the government to take some steam out of the economy to fight inflation was 1968. That's a long time. There have been other episodes since 68 in which fiscal policy turned contractionary, but that was always motivated by concerns about the deficit, not about concerns about the economy. I was in the Clinton administration, and that was an example, right? We promulgated and barely got through Congress by the skin of our teeth, or more accurately, by Al Gore breaking a tie vote in the Senate, a contractionary fiscal policy to reduce the deficit. It was not to bring down inflation. Inflation was 3%. Most of us thought, oh, 3%. We were just talking about 3% inflation. Believe me, Bill Clinton was not concerned that the inflation rate was 3%, and that was terrible. He was concerned about the budget deficit. So there have been some episodes like that, but none since these Keynesian economists you were referring to finally convinced Johnson that we needed to raise taxes because of the Vietnam inflation. And then Johnson, after a year and a half of cajoling, finally convinced Congress to do it. It was a really hard fight. Since then, there's been no fiscal contraction for demand management reasons.
I love taking all of the different scenarios and historical time periods that you talk about in the book and then comparing them to maybe developments that we've seen over the last 10 years or so. And you said recessions at the end of the 50s and the two recessions at the end of the 50s and at the start of the 60s, they didn't see Congress or the White House coming in to help mitigate things. And obviously that is very different from what we saw during the COVID pandemic. So maybe you could talk a bit about that and how things have changed.
Yeah. Those episodes that you just talked about were in the United States, though not in Europe, in the pre-Keynesian era. Keynesianism was considered back then a strange foreign doctrine. Probably some people were calling it communist. I was once called a Maoist Keynesian. I haven't figured out what that is yet. But in those days, in the Eisenhower administration, the Keynesian ideas had just not caught on in the American political world. They had in the academic world. Absolutely. I mean, I was a young student back in the 60s, and we were taught that kind of stuff. But in academia, no. And that was one of the things that was revolutionary, though it took a long time, in Kennedy's call for a tax cut, which he first made in 1962. Let's note the dates. It finally passed in 1964, and only after he was tragically assassinated. We can't run history again, but my best guess is it never would have passed were Kennedy not assassinated, if he was still alive and trying to push it through Congress. There was tremendous resistance to Keynesian ideas, largely because they were going to raise the deficit. In that, if it's Keynesian in that direction, a few minutes ago we were talking about Keynesian in the other direction, trying to throttle back demand. But if it's Keynesianism in the expansionary direction, it's going to raise the deficit. Something Ronald Reagan should have known in 1981. Maybe he did, but that's another story. But the point is that these ideas were foreign and considered kind of revolutionary back then. Not anymore, but back then.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, you know, I still feel like the debate hasn't been settled on exactly how we got where we are today with inflation. And maybe it can't be settled. But, you know, your book really points out the various drivers of inflation throughout history. You know, it was in the 60s, first JFK's tax cuts, and then the big spending on the Vietnam War. Then later in the 70s, it was the, you know, the oil price shock obviously played a big role. I feel like these days we've gotten hit with it all at once. You know, we had the Trump tax cuts, the COVID spending, the war in Ukraine, and the oil price shock, not to mention all the supply chain disruptions during the pandemic. So how, in your head, how do you sort of assign the blame for the inflation problem between, you know, fiscal policy, monetary policy that arguably stayed too loose for too long, the oil shock, on and on. How do you sort of assign the influence of each on where we are now?
Your list is exactly right. Assigning, apportioning the blame is harder and controversial. But my list would put the supply disruptions in the recovery from COVID on the top of the list. They were pervasive all over the place. It wasn't like just one thing. And then would put the supply shocks, which were not 100%, but very much exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. And then the excessive stimulus of the economy. Now, that's the one that's most controversial. People that want to blame Joe Biden or Donald Trump before him latch on to the tremendous fiscal stimulus, and it was a tremendous fiscal stimulus. And that's the kind of thing that you expect to be at least somewhat inflationary. But my view is that the forces clobbering the economy over the head were so powerful that giving some upward impetus to the economy, a substantial upward impetus, was necessary if we weren't going to go into a deep hole. And then finally, we come to the Fed. Part of the blame, this is related, is the Fed started tightening too late. There's unanimity on that. Jerome Powell himself has said that numerous times. We goofed. That's not the way you talk if you're the chairman of the Fed. But he said we goofed and we should have raised interest rates earlier than we should. And that's right. But if you try to put magnitudes to that through models that we use to estimate the effects of monetary policy, remembering also that the mistake was maybe a delay being 3 to 6 months too late, not 2 years too late. It's hard for me to come up with big numbers on that. So yes, the mistake of the Fed did contribute to inflation, but I put it closer to the bottom of the list than to the top of the list.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
One other very interesting anecdote you talk about is the downturn in the first quarter of 1980. And you said consumers voluntarily stopped spending. They sort of stepped in to do their part, to help out, which is, I don't know, I just find that so fascinating, because the prints, the data prints that we've gotten in recent weeks have shown really strong retail spending numbers, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe you can tell us more about that.
It was the second quarter of 1980. Jimmy Carter was president, and inflation, of course, was the problem of the day, the economic problem of the day. In a speech, he urged people to put away their credit cards and not use them and spend less. He also pushed Paul Volcker, who wasn't too happy about it, to invoke credit controls on banks. Something we don't normally do. And Volcker was very unhappy about doing it, but felt that Carter was giving him and the Fed such a free rein to do nasty things that were against Carter's political interest that he ought to at least go along and do that. But coming to what you asked, an astonishing number of people tore up their credit cards and wrote to the White House, "Here's my torn up credit card. I'm not using it anymore," to try to help the fight against inflation. I don't remember what I thought at the time, but I'm sure I was astonished. To take you back a little bit further, it was only about 6 years earlier that Gerry Ford, as president, tried something similar. They were issuing WIN buttons, WIP Inflation Now, W-I-N. I still have mine as a historical souvenir. It was a joke. Nobody did anything. So I certainly didn't think Carter's urging people to tear up their credit cards was going to do anything, but boy, was I wrong. And consumer spending just fell off a cliff. It sort of looked like what happened at the beginning of the pandemic. That was a bigger cliff. But a smaller version of that happened in the second quarter of 1980. It was so severe, the contraction, that both Volcker and Carter got scared. Like, this economy is sliding downhill really rapidly. And Volcker eased up on monetary policy, and Carter reversed field and took away the controls. But while it lasted, it was a whopper.
I just can't imagine people ripping up their credit cards today.
Well, neither could I then. Yeah. If you ask me if Joe Biden did the same today, would people listen? My guess is no. But I remember having the same guess in the Jimmy Carter case.
Well, it gets to the notion of communication, at least, you know, from the White House can be influential. I remember reading that, yeah, Carter, people would actually mail their ripped up cards to the White House. I imagine at some point maybe he wanted to tape them back together and send them back out, return to sender. But Professor, I wanted to get to that notion of Fed communications. You know, you said earlier how in the Greenspan era, Alan Greenspan wouldn't necessarily come out and push back against the market's interpretation of right. Fed policy. Obviously, in this era, Chair Powell has been very vocal about more communication is better. But I feel like it's a difficult needle to thread, because say, you know, you're the Fed chair and you do believe that inflation is under control and that it'll continue to normalize. And maybe by the end of the year, we'll be back at 2%. That's a dangerous opinion to communicate to the market, because investors hear it. The markets go wild, stocks go up, yields come down, and you run the risk of loosening the financial conditions enough to sort of defeat your own purposes. So, I hate to use the word subterfuge or misleading, but is it possible that Fed officials kind of come across a little more hawkish than maybe they are in their hearts in order to avoid that type of thing?
Yeah, I think so. And what I was going to say, what they definitely do is stay away from interesting or colorful adjectives and adverbs. Be boring. Say it boringly. You know, just the opposite of what you want to do in a media show.
That's why everything's modest and moderate. And that's sort of...
I mean, they use boring prose. And in the statements, in the formal statements, as you know, you tend to see the same words over and over and over again. You know, if you think that's designed to put you to sleep, it is. They don't want you getting hyper excited, because they know, and this is the other point, it's inherent in the financial world they live in that markets will overreact. This is not a surprise to the Fed. This is not something it wasn't expecting. It's always expecting markets to overreact, and they just about always do. The nice thing, so that's the bad thing about markets. The nice thing about markets is they tend to self-correct. When they see, oh, the Fed's not going to cut interest rates next month, they reprice securities. So they do correct. And to come back to the way you introduced this question, the Fed nowadays, not in the old days, but nowadays helps them with that by basically saying politely, you guys got it wrong. And here's the way you should be thinking about what we're thinking. That was what I was alluding to. Alan Greenspan just refused to do that in the 90s. He wouldn't. But Ben Bernanke started doing it. Janet Yellen did it. And Jay Powell does it.
You also said in the book that you once asked Volcker how monetary policy crushes inflation. And he said by causing bankruptcies.
Yeah. You're a close reader.
I gasped when I read that.
She's in three different book clubs, Professor.
You're a close reader. And yes, I was shocked by that. I mean, yeah, very surprised by that too. This was a conversation we had. Paul Volcker between Fed jobs spent a year or 2 years as a visiting professor at Princeton. And I had a number of discussions with him. And I was engaged, as a lot of macroeconomists were engaged, in different theories of how monetary policy works. So one day at lunch, I figured, well, I have the former chairman of the Fed right here. Let me ask him how he thought it worked. And that's what he gave me as an answer. Not that he relished it, but he thought that's how it actually worked.
So, Professor, let's kind of get your state of mind right now for how the rest of the year turns out. Is it basically a plateau in rates and still that chance of a soft landing amid that? Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I don't think we're at the plateau yet. I think the Fed is going to go up a bit more and then probably plateau and watch what happens. Soft landings are tough. And the higher the Fed goes, the tougher it is to land softly. And so the odds are moving in the wrong direction right now. But I, you know, if I was betting on this, depending, of course, on the definition of the bet of what's a soft landing, I guess I would handicap it as just a hair below 50% chance. And an important part of that, Mike, by the way, is that unlike some previous Feds in history, including the one I served on in the 90s, this FOMC wants to achieve a soft landing if it can. Many of them have said that, either directly or indirectly, and that includes Chairman Powell. If you had asked Paul Volcker in 1981, are you shooting for a soft landing? He'd have laughed. He said, with this kind of a problem, there's no way we land softly. This is going to be a crash landing.
And what's interesting in your book, you point out, I think many people believe that it's a pipe dream to engineer a soft landing. But as you point out in the book, it's happened.
It has happened.
It's happened several times in history.
Yes. Right? Yeah. It depends on your definition. But yes, it has happened several times in history. Yeah. Right.
Well, fingers crossed it happens again. With that said, Professor, we can't let you go just yet because we have a tradition on this podcast where we all like to observe the craziest things we've seen in markets and economics and whatever's in your wheelhouse in the last week or so. Valdana, why don't you start? What's the craziest thing you've seen in the past week?
I think this technically was at the end of the prior week, but I'm going to go with it because it's striking. Okay, Blackstone's CEO, Steve Schwarzman. Did you see this?
I'd have to hear the rest.
Okay.
I know he's been in the news quite a bit.
This is big. He took home a record $1.27 billion in 2022.
$1.27 billion.
Be like boy.
Not bad work if you can get it, Professor. What do you think?
That's more than Princeton pays me. You know, I don't want to talk down to your audience, but some of the rewards in the financial sector seem way out of line with their contributions to society.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing Steve Schwarzman isn't listening to this podcast.
Even if he is.
I don't think there's much debate on that. That's pretty good. All right, I'll give you mine. Mine's courtesy of the Twitter user Zoran Lalvani. It's on the hustle.co website. Valdana, what was your favorite toy as a child?
I had this Barbie that I really wanted. And my mom got it for me for my birthday. And if you press this button on like her abdomen, she sang a song.
And oh, really?
And I wanted it for forever. And the day I got it, my sister took the doll. She was so mad, jealous, I guess, and ran it over with her tricycle like 50 times. Like she basically flattened the Barbie into a pancake.
Oh my gosh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. That's a traumatic memory to be bring it up for you.
My sister listens to the podcast, so I have to call her out for being evil.
Well, mine's related because my favorite toy was Hot Wheels, you know, the little toy cars. Uh-huh. And apparently Mattel had such a hit with Barbie that they came out, they're like, well, now we got to sell something to the boys. So they came out with Hot Wheels. So this story on the Hustle.co website talks about this guy, Bruce Pascal, who's got a $1.5 million collection of Hot Wheels. Pretty extensive collection, but in order to turn this into our game show, the price is precise. I want you to guess the most expensive, most highly valued Hot Wheels. It hasn't sold in a while, but what the collectors estimate is the most highly valued Hot Wheel in his collection. And I'll give you a little details on here. It was a prototype for the 1969 rear-loading Beach Bomb, which was basically kind of looks like one of those old Volkswagen vans. It has a surfboard coming out the back.
Oh, I like those. Yeah, they're cute.
There are only 40-some of them made, but this was the actual prototype. So what's your bid? What's your bid on that?
For this one car.
One 1969 rear-loading Beach Bomb surfer van Hot Wheels.
Okay. Then I'll go with $200,000.
$200,000. That was a very quick and confident answer on your part. Professor, what do you think? If you're on the Price is Right, what are you bidding for the world's most expensive Hot Wheel?
Definitely less than $200,000. But I'll tell you what you just both taught me. My six-year-old grandson has a burgeoning collection of Hot Wheels. I'm going to make sure he doesn't do with it what I did with my collection of baseball cards when I was six.
What'd you do with them?
I just let it go to rotten. We put them in our bicycle spokes and we took them outside in the rain. And, you know, I probably had a Mickey Mantle from 1950 something, but I don't have it anymore.
It was put in the.
So I'm going to go lower, 100,000.
100,000. Boy, you guys split the difference perfectly. It was 150,000. Dollars is the value. So I think Price's precise rules, we have to give it to Professor Binder here. You
I think so, yeah.
Item for your resume there, Professor. You win the Price's precise on what goes.
And I'm not buying.
Not really bidding on that Hot Wheel. How about you, Alan? Have you seen anything crazy recently?
Sure. To me, almost everything about cryptocurrency is crazy. So you can start with Sam. And it doesn't stop with that company was once valued in the market at $25 billion. I'll put that up as crazy.
Yeah. What do you think? Is it the loose monetary policy that a lot of people blame? What, as a economics professor and historian with your credentials?
For things like that?
How do you explain the boom in crypto?
There have been fads and crazes like that throughout history. When I talk about the stock market in Economics 101, I tell my students that the first bubble in the stock market happened with the very first company. It was the South Sea Bubble in England.
Right.
The first listed company, basically. And already they're having a bubble. So people have gone crazy. And then there was the tulip bulb craze and the tech stock craze. And, you know, you go on and on and on. It just happens in speculative markets always.
Just inevitable sort of human nature to
people get hyper excited about the new thing, and they wind up paying outrageous prices.
Yeah, yeah.
You only know they're outrageous later.
Right. Well, great perspective, Professor Alan Binder of Princeton University. We really appreciate your time and your insights. I think you really helped a lot of us think about the current state of affairs, especially from that really important historical perspective that you bring with your new book. It's called A Monetary and Fiscal History of the United States, 1961 to 2021. Thank you so much for your time.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you, Professor. What Goes Up? We'll be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show so more listeners can find us. and you can find us on Twitter. Follow me, at Vildana Heirich. Mike Regan is at Reganonymous. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong, and our head of podcasts is Sage Bauman. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.